Hello, everyone. This is Med School Moose, the podcast. Nope, I already messed up. Because I don't, that's not how I necessarily phrase it. We'll just try again. It gets better, I swear. Hello, everyone. This is Med School Moose, the podcast that explores interesting stories in medicine and helps you be successful throughout your medical school education. As always, I'm your host, Masood, and on today's show, I'll be talking with Dr. Ellie Ragone about LGBTQ in healthcare. Okay, so LGBTQ issues are one of the big and hot topics in society today. But one aspect of this argument that people probably aren't thinking about as much is healthcare and medicine. So to kind of discuss that in further detail today, I have a guest. Dr. Ellie Ragone is a first-year emergency medicine resident at Bay State Medical Center and one of my co-interns. Ellie, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So I do want to start off by giving a little bit of context. So you are transgender, and you transitioned from male to female. And when did you do that?
So, yes, I'm transgender. I transitioned socially. I did my social transition in May of last year now, 2019. But I had started HRT or hormone replacement therapy back in January of 2019.
Wow. Okay. So this has all been within the past year. So it's pretty recent. And you were doing this amongst a lot of other changes, you know, transitioning from being a fourth-year medical student to being a resident physician. Can you describe what it was like when you made that decision?
Yeah, it was definitely an enlightening experience for me. I made that decision in December of 2018 after being encouraged by some of my close friends from medical school to be more expressive in discovering who I was and the person that I was. I had always been pretty boring in terms of my expression, in terms of my dress, and in terms of who I showed myself to be. And it turns out that a lot of that was suppressed gender dysphoria. So I had decided back in December, January timeframe, so almost a year ago now, that I wanted to really come out to who I was and realize that I was transgender at that point. I also realized that I had a great opportunity in regards to transitioning publicly with the start of residency. Residency allows us to, many of us, I should say, to start over, essentially. A lot of us are moving sometimes across the country. So our co-residents moved across the country. You moved from down south. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate. I didn't move too far, but I was still moving to a new city. And along with that came with giving up all of my previous social circles, as well as my co-workers. So that meant where I was going, no one would know my dead name. No one would know me as the person I was when I was presenting male.
Wow. So I have to ask the obvious question here. So this is fourth year of medical school. Mm-hmm. There's so much going on. There's applying for residency. There's interviews. There's the match process. I mean, I've been making episodes on all of these big things that take up so much time and are so stressful. How are you balancing all of those medical and educational things with this big life change and these social changes?
It was definitely very scary. And that's a word that you'll hear come up a lot in this interview. Yeah. A big part of every part of this process is scary. I was fortunate. Like many medical students probably here, the end of fourth year tends to be pretty easygoing, can be pretty chill. Some people end up having a couple leftover rotations to finish that are rough. But I was fortunate in that I was able to schedule my time to be very independent as well as not involved in patient care. So I did a month of teaching. I did 2 months of research. So I was able to really schedule my time such that I was able to focus on myself while still maintaining my medical school obligations.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really great that you were kind of able to schedule things to really make yourself more comfortable and accustomed to everything that was going on. But I know you said you were encouraged by some people. Did you have any help or guidance through this whole process? Because this is, I mean, like you said, this is scary.
Yeah, it's definitely a scary process. The biggest guidance, and I'm thankful to grow up in 2020 now, you know, throughout the 2010s, the internet became much more populated with communities of varying types, and there's a bunch of great transgender communities available online that you can get a lot of resources from. that you can get a lot of stories from other people about. I was also very fortunate, and one of the big factors in my transition was where I ended up. So I was at a small community hospital in the southern tier of New York for the end of fourth year medical school. And I was fortunate that a friend of a friend had just started his family medicine residency there. And conveniently, he's a trans man, and he actually went to medical school for the sole purpose of trying to provide care for the transgender population. So he was very eager to take care of me and to work with me in helping to explore who I was and who I wanted to show the world I was.
Wow, that's really great. But I'm curious, because like I said, fourth year of medical school, going through all these big changes in terms of becoming an actual physician, what do you think was the hardest part for you of applying to residency and going through this whole process as transitioning and being transgender?
Probably the hardest part for me was the same as everyone else who has transitioned, and that's with changing your identity to the world at large. Every time I'm misgendered or I see my dead name on an email or a letter, it's just a reminder that the world doesn't necessarily see me as the person that I really am. And it's kind of hurtful. When you have a cisgendered individual who gets misgendered, it often just leads to confusion. For someone who's transgender, it's much more hurtful. It's a reminder that you're not seeing that person as who they really are, and it's just a reminder to themselves that the world doesn't see them as who they really are and who they're trying to show the world they are. And those were some of the hardest issues, especially being earlier in my transition, within the first 6 months or so when I didn't have any of the physical changes of HRT showing up yet. I didn't have any of the benefits of longer hair or other styling or dressing and finding what clothes I was comfortable in and things like that, that the world really wasn't seeing me as female and was the hardest part of it. When I was really early in transition, I still had my masculine voice. It took a lot of time with the voice teacher to work on my voice and become much more feminine in my voice. I'm thankful for the work I've done there. And I've been very, very fortunate in that I've been able to afford all of this. Transgender individuals are usually don't have the resources that I'm very, very fortunate to have. I was able to stay with a friend during this whole process for free, and that allowed me to use a lot of my loan money towards this transition, towards laser hair removal and getting a new wardrobe and trying to change my appearance on the outside to help match who I was on the inside.
Yeah, I think that's really great, and it sounds like you did have a fair amount of support in going through this whole transition. And I do want to back up real quick and just mention, by HRT, you're referring to hormone replacement therapy, correct?
Yeah, exactly. HRT, hormone replacement therapy, takes on a few forms. For some great reference material, I'll refer your listeners to two documents. One is the WPATH guidelines, WPATH. Mm-hmm. As well as the San Francisco Transgender Health Guidelines. Both of those have documents detailing ways in which physicians can care for transgender patients. I think the San Francisco guidelines are a little more progressive, but a lot of insurance companies are still using the WPATH guidelines.
Okay, well, thank you so much for those resources. And you did mention a little bit in terms of transgender healthcare, and we're definitely going to get there because I think that's a big part of this conversation. But before that, I do have one more question, because this is, of course, a big transition, and we've been using words like scary and nervous and those kinds of things. But correct me if I'm wrong, I have to imagine that in some aspect, this is also a little bit freeing, because you're getting a new start, you're getting to really accept the person that you want to be and to make those changes. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Absolutely. Probably the most freeing day of my life was when I came out publicly. About January, or around the time that I realized I was transgender and wanted to transition, and May, when I came out publicly or socially, I was living essentially two lives. I had my medical school obligations, in which my medical school still thought I was male. The hospitals I was working at expected a male to be presenting. I was still using my dead name in those cases. Whereas in my personal life, in my social life, when I would go shopping with friends or to the movies or whatever, I was dressing and being myself. I was being Ellie. So I was living kind of two lives, and it was exhausting. It was also very uncomfortable to be essentially dressing up as a male when I knew I was female, and see the world see me as male and to address me as male when I knew I wasn't. And like I talked about before, it was just another reminder every time I had to go into those situations that the world wasn't really seeing me who I was. And in that instance, it was entirely my decision, because I had not come out publicly, but it was still hurtful and it was still difficult to go through. once I came out publicly, it was the most freeing thing in the world for me. It basically allowed me to completely give up my male identity and never have to put up with being deadnamed or being misgendered ever again. And so that day was one of the most freeing days of my life. And it's definitely been, I've definitely become a different person since then as well. A lot of my friends comment, and I'm brought back to one instance with my voice teacher, where she was saying one of the ways that helps to feminize the voice is to have basically almost a smile when you're talking. And she was saying that that would be easy for me as I'm a happy person. And some of my friends here in residency have commented the same. And I always laugh when I hear it because I was never that type of person. Before I transitioned, I hated myself. I was never happy. I'd never in a million years would anyone have described me as a happy person. And to hear people describe me that way now is strange, but also so wonderful. It's so nice to be who I really am now that the world sees me for who I am.
Yeah, wow. I think that's so beautiful. And I'm really glad that you were able to do these things and take these steps to kind of get more comfortable in your own skin. And I can definitely confirm that you are a super happy person. I'm pretty sure every time that I've seen you, you've had a big smile on your face and it really brightens my day. Now, I want to switch gears here and talk about the LGBT community and healthcare, which I think is the big kind of topic of the conversation today. Now, what have your experiences been as a transgender patient, first of all?
So as a transgender patient, it's been very scary. As I mentioned, that tends to come up a lot in this process. There are so many stories of transgender patients being, frankly, abused by the healthcare system that it's one of the big reasons why so few transgender patients see doctors at all. It's why they're afraid to go to the hospital. It's why they're afraid to get care. There's a whole movement in gender identity circles towards doing at-home hormone replacement therapy where they find black market testosterone and estrogen and inject themselves at unknown dosages with unknown safety and efficacy of these drugs because they're just so afraid of going to a doctor. Combine that with the cost of these processes or the regulations regarding them. In some countries, they have to wait months or years in order to get these issues treated. It's a real burden for a lot of these patients. For me in particular, I've had good experiences, but it's still somewhat scary. At what point do I need to tell this doctor that I'm on hormones or that I have gender dysphoria or that my anatomy is not matched that of all their other female patients? I'm very fortunate in that obviously I'm very medically literate, but many transgender patients are not. And some are going to be even more hesitant to bring up these issues. There was a case not too long ago of a man that came into the emergency department with abdominal pain. Doctors couldn't figure out what was going on for a couple hours until he gave birth to two babies. That patient was clearly too afraid to bring up the issue that he was a trans man and that he might be pregnant. And that just illustrates the challenges this community faces in being afraid of doctors. And I hope as we grow as a community of healthcare providers, as a community of LGBT persons, and as a society as a whole, this becomes a much more normalized process. And we can talk about that more as we talk about the other side of the coin, which is treating LGBT patients as a healthcare provider.
Yeah, and I do kind of want to touch on that a little bit because you have an interesting perspective, obviously having been a transgender patient, and now you are a transgender physician. So what have your experiences been as a transgender doctor?
Pretty unremarkable, which is, I think, as good as I can have hoped for. Now, of course, my experiences are going to be somewhat unique given that I live in the Northeast. I live in a very open and accepting part of the country. If I was perhaps in upstate New York or in the South or other places where people like me are not as accepted, it wouldn't be an issue. But it's been pretty unremarkable. A lot of my patients gender me correctly. Those that don't come up with some of the most remarkable answers when I correct them. I had one patient that I introduced myself to as Ellie. And when she misgendered me, I said, actually, it's she, her. That's my pronouns. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry. I thought you said your name was Elliot. And I still laugh about it because I'm pretty sure Elliot is really a gender neutral name. So, but in her head, she had to come up with some reason why she misgendered me in order to explain it. And that's the answer her brain went to. But everyone's been very open and very accepting of me. When I correct them, they use the right pronouns. So it's been a process, but it's as good as I can hope right now. As I mentioned before, I'm only at this point about a year into my transition medically, so I'm still just getting into some of the physical effects that I can hope to obtain from HRT. My hair is still much shorter than I want it to be, but certainly coming in much longer now than it was a year ago. So there's other aspects of myself that are becoming more feminine in nature, and that the world sees me as more feminine now than a year ago. So I think it's an issue that will continue to improve over time.
Yeah, it sounds like this is definitely more of a process, of course, than a big transition point. But I'm glad that it's been mostly unremarkable. So now I want to go back to what we were talking about right before that. We were talking about some of the issues facing individuals in the LGBT community. And we could talk about this for hours, but my listeners will probably get bored long before then. I do want to drop a couple statistics, though, and I'll leave the resources in the show notes. So here's just a couple that I found. Obviously, there's many. More than 50% of LGBTQ individuals identify as having faced some form of discrimination while seeking medical treatment. That's one. LGBTQ people of color are more than twice as likely to avoid a doctor's office than white LGBTQ individuals. And then the last one that I found, which is pretty surprising and frustrating to me as a resident physician, only about 16% of LGBTQ patients choose to inform their doctor about their sexual orientation. Now, there's so much that we could unwrap there, but I'm going to kind of leave the earnest to you. What do you think are some of the biggest issues facing the LGBT community in medicine?
Great question. So there's two aspects of this that I want to touch on, one from the LGBT community side and one from the provider or practitioner side. Speaking as someone from the community, the bottom line is most doctors don't know what they're doing. As far as I'm aware, transgender care is not part of any ACGME requirement for the curriculum for any primary care specialty, so primarily talking about internal medicine and family medicine. I'm sure it's probably included in endocrinology fellowship and things like that. So most doctors aren't getting education on how to care for these patients. As I mentioned before, we do have some guidelines out there, but the doctors have to be interested in going to pursue them. Additionally, you have to be comfortable as a physician just reading a guideline and then taking care of patients, which I can tell you as a doctor is not the most comfortable thing. If after I graduate residency, I read a guideline on something I never did, never talked to anyone about, and now I'm supposed to prescribe a medication for a patient, it's a scary process.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that's the case for most transgender patients. Thankfully, those guidelines do exist, and we do have some doctors that are becoming much more comfortable with these prescriptions and helping patients get the resources they need. Additionally, in today's world of the internet, there's a lot more resources available both for providers and for patients in order to help find doctors who are comfortable doing this. For better or worse, it ends up being that smaller towns and cities will only have a couple of providers, and for those providers, all of their practice tends to be transgender care after a certain amount of time because everyone just refers their patients to them if they're not comfortable taking care of patients who need HRT or other resources. The biggest thing for the LGBT community is to make sure that they're aware themselves and can help their doctors learn. Plenty of doctors out there want to learn, just don't know where. Point your doctors towards the WPATH guidelines and the San Francisco guidelines. Point them towards these organizations and tell them to reach out if they have questions. And certainly your nearest academic center will have a center of some kind dedicated towards taking care of transgender patients, whether that's only a couple doctors or whether it's an entire center like Mount Sinai's Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York City. As a healthcare provider, we need to start changing the way we take care of these patients. We need to accept that they exist and that they're a part of our societies and that they're a part of our patient panels, whether we're in the emergency department, whether we're in the operating room, whether we're on the floor, or whether we're in the outpatient setting. These need to be a normal part of our patient panels. There are many ways for us to go about this, and I don't necessarily have the right answer. I heard a great recommendation at ASAP last year about starting every conversation with every patient on their preferred pronouns. And this can certainly help to open the door for the transgender patients to come out and say, oh, and also I'm transgender. Not all will, but some might. We also have a big challenge in healthcare in terms of taking care of these patients in an evidence-based manner. Although there are certainly plenty of transgender patients that we take care of, we will never reach the same volume of patients as we do with all the others that we perform studies on. Therefore, all of these studies that we have don't necessarily apply to transgender patients. For example, I was at the cardiologist's office yesterday because I go into AFib sometimes, and I was talking with the doctor about my CHADS-VASc score. One of the questions in the CHADS-VASc is female sex. What's the answer for me? My gender is female. I was born male. My current hormonal status is female. So what's the risk? Do I have an increased risk? Do I not? And unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever reach the point of getting adequate research on all of these important topics for transgender patients. Therefore, I think the best option is to take it on an individual approach. I'd love to see more topics from our medical ethicists talking about how we should approach these patients when it comes to research. How can we best apply our research knowledge towards patients in which there will never be adequate research done? As a provider, I think it's important to make sure you just have an open and honest discussion with every patient, essentially having a shared decision-making conversation, recognizing that there is no defined research that can truly guide us. And every test, every score, every tool we have is going to be biased against the transgender population and will never be accurate for a transgender patient. So when you're calculating PERC or Wells or CHADS-VASc, whatever the case may be, keep that in mind that although this can provide you some information, that score at the end of these tools is not going to mean the same thing as it does in a cisgendered individual. Again, I hope we have more discussion and more guidelines that can come out and help us identify these issues, especially in our acute setting, rather than resorting to admitting these patients when we don't know what to do with them.
Yeah, I think that was a great response, and I think you unwrapped a lot of important topics. And sitting here and listening to you talk about, honestly, a lot of things that I hadn't really considered before, I think the one word that popped into my mind was inclusivity. I'm pretty sure that's a word. That's a word, right?
It is now.
Okay. Inclusivity. Just in terms of asking your patients their preferred pronouns or asking your patients questions that, let's be honest, some doctors maybe feel a little bit uncomfortable asking sometimes, sexual activity, sexual orientation, those kinds of things. Even inclusivity to the point of, are these LGBTQ patients being addressed and considered in research and in protocols and in the rules that we use in the medical arena every day? And it's going to be a process to kind of get more inclusive, but I think we're definitely making progress. Ellie, I have two more questions for you, and you kind of already started to answer them, but I'm going to ask them anyways, just for my own sense of closure, and that's just in terms of advice. So my first question is going to be, what advice do you have for healthcare workers interacting with LGBTQ patients?
Great question. The best advice is just to treat them like anyone else and to normalize all parts of your exam. If you're asking about their sexual history for a wellness exam, then ask about their sexual activity just like you ask them about their family history of stroke and heart attack. There's no need to preface it with, oh, I ask all my patients, just ask it like you do anything else. Are you currently sexually active? Do you have sex with men, women, both, or someone who identifies as neither? All of these questions can be treated just like any other part of medicine. When we start treating them as such, patients will also start recognizing, oh, this is just the doctor doing their job, trying to make sure that they're taking the best care of me. For doctors who have intake forms and have their own clinics and practices, making sure that you have a gender and sexual identity inclusive document for the patients to fill out. Include options other than just male and female, gay and straight. Certainly including those checkbox options for the statistically most common is appropriate, but you should also leave space open for patients to self-identify however suits them best. I even heard about one practice recently that assigns little Pokemon figurines to all their patients. And then when the patient gets called back, they're called back by that figurine and not by the patient's name in order to help preserve that patient's privacy even one step further.
I think we should start doing that in the emergency department, personally.
Absolutely.
Charmander in room 5 is having chest pain. We should probably get on that. Okay, and then my very last question, Ellie. You have I can only imagine, gone through so much this past year, becoming a resident, transitioning from male to female, and all of the little nuances that, let's be honest, I have very little familiarity with. But what advice do you have for people who identify as part of the LGBTQ community and are working in healthcare, similar to yourself?
The best advice I can give is not to be afraid to be yourself. I know that for many members of the LGBT community, they're not able to escape the prejudice that they face every single day. But just know, when you're looking for a job, if you're a medical student listening to this podcast, applying to residencies, there are residencies out there that will accept you for who you really are, whether you're gay or straight or transgender or cisgender or anything else. They will accept you if you're willing to learn and you're willing to take care of patients. That's all that matters. I also want to say to members of the community working in healthcare that there is a two-edged sword with being a member of that community and working in healthcare. I knew when I transitioned, I was going to be a doctor who was transgender, and as such, I would be in a position to truly advocate for other members of the community. However, I knew until recently, I was not ready to do that. I want to stress to other members of the LGBT community working in healthcare that you have no obligation to take on that mantle. If you want to, I empower you to do so. If you don't want to, please do not feel ashamed or like you're doing anything wrong by not taking up that mantle and not fighting for transgender rights or gay rights or anything else. For some people, it comes naturally. For some people, they want nothing to do with it. All I ask is that you be yourself, and I hope you find a home that accepts you for who you are. I know I have.
Wow, that was so amazing, and I'm glad that you were able to share that advice with all of my listeners, and I'm glad that you're so comfortable here. I know we all love having you as one of our co-interns. Ellie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and share all of this awesome information.
Thanks for taking the time to help shed light on this important issue.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Med School Moose. As always, if you have any suggestions for future topics, please leave me a comment or suggestion. And if you don't, then leave me a positive rating and some feedback, because I'll enjoy that too. Thank you so much for listening.